Gentlemen, this evening's lecture is very much a continuation of last week's lecture. Last week, I discussed in brief outline the nature of self-esteem, why self-esteem is a fundamental psychological need of man, what conditions are necessary for the attainment of self-esteem, and how self-esteem is commonly betrayed. In discussing man's need of self-esteem, I drew your attention to the fact that the root of that need lies in the fact that man is a being of volitional consciousness. Now then, the fact that man is a being of volitional consciousness and the fact that his life depends upon the exercise of his mind, upon his reason, imposes upon man a solemn responsibility. The fact, to repeat, that man is a rational being, a being whose basic means of survival is his mind, and the fact that man is a being of volitional consciousness imposes upon man a solemn responsibility, one which many men revolt against and seek to escape. What is the nature of this responsibility? Since man's rational faculty does not function automatically, man must, first of all, choose to initiate a reasoning process. He must choose to check and test his conclusions by constant observation and by a rigorous process of logic, and he must choose to be guided by his rational judgment. Since his consciousness is not infallible, he can make an error at any step of the way. If he leaves the error uncorrected and acts on it, he will be acting against the facts of reality, and suffering and self-destruction will be the result. Alone, facing the universe, relying exclusively upon his own mind, man has to be crucially concerned that he use his mind properly, that he exercise his rational powers to the utmost, that he know what he is doing when he acts, that he knows what he is doing and why when he chooses the values he chooses, because should he choose wrong and act wrong, to repeat, suffering and self-destruction will be the result. Now, there are two ways, in essence, that a man can respond to these facts and to the responsibility they entail. A man can accept and welcome them, or he can resent and dread them. The first response leads to the achievement of self-esteem. The second, to neurosis, to anxiety, to inferiority complex. A psychologically healthy man is one who accepts the responsibility entailed in being a volitional being, who accepts the responsibility of thought, who accepts the responsibility of choice, who accepts and welcomes the responsibility of passing judgments. And that includes passing judgment on the issue of values, on the values and goals by which he is to live that are going to guide his actions and his life. Now, it's possible for man, and indeed many men do, to revolt against the responsibility inherent in their own nature, to seek escape from the responsibility of volition, to evade the effort of thought, to prefer a state of mental fog, and to drift at the mercy of blind feelings. It's possible, in a word, to a greater or lesser extent, to rebel against the necessity of judging reality and of judging it independently with one's own mind. To the extent to which one rebels against this responsibility, one defaults on the process of proper human growth, one sabotages one's own intellectual development, one doesn't grow intellectually as one should, and to this extent one sabotages the efficacy of one's mind. And the consequence of this is to sentence oneself to the mounting terror of feeling that one is inadequate to and unfit for existence. To the extent to which a person rebels against the responsibility of thinking, and to the extent to which he seeks to solve the problem by relying on the consciousness of others instead, to that extent he sabotages his own intellectual and psychological growth, he sabotages his intellectual development, and he declares himself, in effect, a second-rate citizen metaphysically. That is, he accepts the fact, early in life, that he is not to come into first-hand contact with reality, so to speak, that he is not going to think and judge and choose on his own. This is too much trouble. The risks are too great if he fails. And so instead he will look to others to provide for him the guidance which his own thinking should have provided instead. This state, of course, is not reached in a day, a week, or a month. It is the cumulative result of a long succession of defaults, evasions, and irrationalities. A long succession of failures to use one's mind properly. Confronted with the choice to initiate the mental effort needed to pursue knowledge, to focus his mind to think or not to bother, the irrationalist characteristically chooses not to bother, particularly if crucial issues are at stake. Why particularly if crucial issues are at stake? Because the risk is that much more terrifying. Because he does not want his life or happiness to depend upon anything so fragile, as he sees it, as his own mind. Confronted with the choice to stand by the judgment of his mind or to act on feelings, wishes, or fears, which he knows to be irrational, he characteristically sticks by his feelings and defies his mind in validating its judgment. For example, he indulges wishes which he knows to be irrational. He gives in to fears which he knows to be irrational. And doing so again and again, he builds up in his mind this kind of precedent. In any clash within me between my mind or my rational judgment and a strong feeling, it's my mind that goes. That, in effect, is the operating premise which after a while becomes implicit. And this, of course, in turn undermines enormously any self-esteem that he might possess, because he knows that there is a fundamental corruption built into the mechanism, built into the fundamental psycho-epistemological policy of the mechanism. Confronted with the choice between his own understanding and the assertions of others, he characteristically abandons his own understanding, finding it safer to pass the responsibility of judgment to others. This is one of the most widespread forms in which men can attempt to revolt against the requirements of their own nature. However, there is no escape from reality. There is no escape from man's nature and from the manner of survival that his nature requires. Every living species that possesses awareness can survive only by the guidance of its consciousness. That is the role and the function of consciousness in a living organism. Man can survive only by the guidance of his kind of consciousness, a consciousness that has to function volitionally, that has to focus, perceive, draw abstractions, gain knowledge, pass judgments, form values, decide what are the right goals to pursue in order to survive and to procure his well-being. If a man rejects this responsibility, if he decides that thinking is too much effort, that the perception of reality is not his concern, why then if he wants to survive, he can survive only by means of the perceptions and the judgments of others. If he does not choose to judge reality himself, the only choice open to him is to follow blindly the judgments of others. He does not know what to do, but he does know that knowledge is required to make decisions in face of the countless alternatives that confront him every day of his life. He knows that he has nothing to guide him inside his mind but the chaotic jumble of random notions, snatches of unformulated impressions, bits of unintegrated ideas, pieces of unpursued thoughts, whirling and swimming in the fog of his one constant emotion, namely anxiety. He knows that he does not know how to live, but others seem to know it. Others have survived and are surviving around him. So the only way to survive, he feels, is to follow their lead and to live by their knowledge. They know, and they will spare him the risk and the effort. They know. Somehow, they possess control of that mysterious, unknowable reality. He does not have to know or to perceive the world as it is and assume the responsibility of judgment, so he feels. Instead, he can look at people, watch what they do, guess what they see, get attuned to their manner of thinking, and develop a skill for a special sight, the world as perceived by others. Thus, he is led to shape his soul in the image of a parasite inconceivable in any other living species. Not a parasite of body, but a parasite of consciousness. Now, what I wish to emphasize is the following. What this type of person seeks is not material support. Oh, some men of this type are financial moochers, but they are comparatively a minority, and the state of being a material parasite is only the consequence of a deeper mental cause anyway. No, this type seeks a consciousness other than his own to replace the mind he has chosen to discard. He is begging humanity at large to take care of him on a level far deeper than financial, to tell him how to live. This means to set his goals, to choose his values, to prescribe his actions, never to leave him alone at the mercy of his own unreliable mind. He may be willing to work, to obey, and even to think within a limited square if others will assume responsibility for his ultimate direction. Now, to understand his psychology, let us contrast it very briefly with that of a man of authentic, healthy self-esteem. A man of self-esteem and sovereign consciousness deals with reality, with nature, with an objective universe of facts. He holds his mind as his tool of survival, and he develops his ability to think. But the man who has abandoned his mind lives not in a universe of facts, but in a universe of people. People, not facts, are his reality. People, not reason, are his tool of survival. It is with them that he has to deal. It is on them that his consciousness must focus. It is them who he must understand, or please, or placate, or deceive, or maneuver, or manipulate, or obey. It is his success at this task that becomes the gauge of his fitness to exist, of his competence to live. Having alienated himself from objective reality, he has no other standard of truth, no other standard of rightness or personal worth. To grasp and successfully to satisfy the expectations, the conditions, demands, terms, values of others is experienced by him as his deepest, most urgent need. The approval of others is his only form of assurance that he is right, that he is doing well. The temporary diminution of his anxiety that their approval offers him is his substitute for self-esteem. Thus, taking you again to the concept of last week's lecture, we can say in a very broad way that this man, early in life, ties his pseudo-self-esteem to to his ability not to deal with the objective facts of reality, but to satisfy the terms, expectations, values, frame of reference of others. Now, men can hold this attitude, this policy, to varying degrees. It can dominate their personality or psychology, or it can be present only to a comparatively small extent. Yes, this form of neurosis can exist in men in various degrees of intensity and various degrees of destructiveness. It exists in the majority of people to some extent. The name which I have given to this particular phenomenon is social metaphysics. Why social metaphysics? I mean this designation to be taken literally. Well, remember, a metaphysics is a view of the nature of reality. One's metaphysics is one's view of the nature of reality. To the man I have been describing, reality is people. In his mind, in his thinking, in the automatic connections of his mind, people occupy the place which, in the mind of a rational man, is occupied by reality. Just as a rational man bases his self-esteem on his ability to deal with objective reality, so this man bases his self-value on his ability to deal with people. What do I mean when I say that in this man's mind, people occupy the place which in the mind of a rational person is occupied by reality? Well, to understand what that means, consider the following. Try to project exactly what we mean when we talk about reality being present in our mind. Ordinarily, we don't think of reality as such in our daily actions. We take it for granted. The concept has become built into our minds as an automatic frame of reference and standard of judgment. So that if, for example, to give a simple example, I asked you, what color is the ceiling of this room? You would automatically almost look up to see it. You would look through the facts of reality. And in such a case, you couldn't imagine what else one could possibly look to or refer to. But if I asked you a more abstract question, such as, for what purpose should man live? Many people would find that the first thought to leap into their mind would not be the question, what in reason is the purpose for which man should live, but rather, what do people think it is? What have I heard said it is? This is social metaphysics. Now, if I asked you, what did you do this morning, and suggested that you take a public poll in order to find out what you did do, you would consider my suggestion absurd. Yet there is no difference in principle between that question and the question, for what moral purpose should man live? Both questions refer to reality, and there is nothing else to refer to. There is, of course, an important difference between these two questions. The second is more abstract than the first. It is in the realm of abstractions that a social metaphysician suspends his judgment. He is willing and able to perceive the immediately given, the concrete and the simplest familiar abstractions, and for the most part to trust his judgment on that level. But it is on the level of higher abstractions, and most particularly on the level of value judgments, that his mind goes blank. And instead of reality, all he thinks of is the consciousness of others, their beliefs, their views, their sense of things, in order to learn the truth. Social metaphysics, then, may be defined and summarized as follows. Social metaphysics is the psychological syndrome. A syndrome means, of course, a collection of symptoms characterizing a specific illness. Social metaphysics is the psychological syndrome that characterizes an individual who holds the consciousnesses of other men not objective reality, as his ultimate psycho-epistemological frame of reference. To repeat, social metaphysics is the psychological syndrome that characterizes an individual who holds the consciousnesses of other men not objective reality as his ultimate psychoepistemological frame of reference. Perhaps the worst form of self-degradation and the worst punishment that social metaphysicians endure is their contempt for their own judgment. A man of sovereign consciousness places nothing higher than reality and no judgment of reality higher than his own. He does not accept an idea as true or valid unless he recognizes it to be so by his own rational understanding. If a social metaphysician judges an idea to be true, the fact that he used his own judgment tends to invalidate the idea. Any conviction he forms lacks conviction for him because it is his own. Any idea advanced by others tends to be extra convincing because it is not his. He feels implicitly that others have a wisdom superior to his own, granted to them by the fact that they are non-himself. He may not always give in to them, but his emotions will always pull him secretly to acknowledge their superiority. His own mind, to him, is not an instrument of certainty, but of self-doubt and mistrust. He feels, who am I to know? Who am I to judge? How can I tell? His attitude amounts to, how can I live my life by the guidance of nothing that's so precarious, so puny, so feeble, so uncertain, so unreliable a thing as my mind? If one discusses the importance of reason with a social metaphysician, he frequently will ask, whose reason? And will proceed to complain that experts disagree in every field, so how can one tell what is reasonable? It will never occur to a man of independent judgment, to a man of sovereign consciousness, to ask such a question as, whose reason? And it never occurs to a social metaphysician that the answer is one's own. Social metaphysicians attach an abnormal emotional significance to the opinions of others, much beyond any practical consideration, beyond any reason they can name, without reason, as a primary. The dislike or disagreement of others has the immediate effect of shaking their judgment, whether they actually give in to others or not. Many a social metaphysician has described to me the following phenomenon. He goes to a party. In the course of a conversation at a party, he expresses some ideas which meet with violent opposition, and in the course of his argument, he feels himself coming apart at the seams psychoepistemologically. He forgets all the facts, arguments, and proofs which he knew to support his own position an hour earlier. He's literally paralyzed in a vice of fear, and he feels he cannot think. He cannot remember facts which he knew perfectly well. Why? What can cause this kind of psychoepistemological paralysis? Something which matters far more to him, because it is an issue of values, something that matters far more to him than the truth or falsehood of the issues involved. Others disagree. Others are frowning or looking angry or indignant or contemptuous or are ridiculing or are expressing opposition in one form or another. That fact liquefies him psychologically. I remember a particular young man who suffered from a rather severe case of social metaphysics, attending college, and he would get into arguments sometimes with his professor or professors, and he would put forth some view, then the professor or the class would express some opposition. The young man wouldn't lose the conviction that his position was true. He wouldn't even, in this particular case, lose the memory of the reasons to support his conviction. Only he would find the following emotional shift occurring. He would have a sense that the ideas involved exist at some infinite distance from him, that they're of no importance one way or the other, that his knowledge that his position is true or right is of no importance, no emotional significance one way or the other. It all feels far away, infinitely far away, and what's up close is only the fear of his classmates' and the professor's opposition or disapproval. Truth doesn't matter to him any longer, nor facts, nor reality, nor his own convictions. What matters is only the fact that others don't think it's true. Afterwards, he walks out of the classroom feeling a wave of self-contempt, feeling like a traitor with justice. In order to understand the peculiar nature of social metaphysics, I have to emphasize once again that the kind of dependence which I am discussing is not primarily a material dependence. It's not an issue of financial support. That can sometimes be involved for individual people, but that's not what the fundamental problem is. The fundamental problem is a person who has either never acquired or relinquished the concept of an objective reality apart from the beliefs, the views, the ideas, the notions of other people. He doesn't have in his mind a clear concept of reality as apart from the consensus of his particular significant others, as it were. I wrote an article in the Objectivist newsletter some time ago dealing with one aspect of the psychology of social metaphysics, in which I told a anecdote, an experience which happened to me around 7 or 8 years ago, which I'd like to repeat for you here because it's very relevant by way of illuminating the nature of the social metaphysician's alienation from reality. The incident really is something of a horror story in a very quiet way. Briefly, it's this. A young man came to see me at the suggestion of a mutual acquaintance who thought that objectivism might help the young man with his personal and professional problems. After I had answered a number of questions concerning the objectivist philosophy, the young man looked at me nervously, and then he said, and this is a verbatim quote, it's not the sort of thing one forgets, "But if I accept these ideas, my friends will kill me. They won't let me live. No one will let you live." "Do you mean," I asked, "that you expect your friends to murder you?" "No, of course not," he answered. "Do you expect them to lock you in a room and starve you to death?" "No." "Well, then what do you mean?" "I mean they won't let me live." I was unable to obtain any other answer from him or any explanation. He kept repeating, "They won't let me live," as if it were a self-evident fact, an axiom understood by everybody and taken for granted. Our mutual acquaintance who had brought him was dumbfounded and kept asking, "What on earth do you mean?" The young man seemed unable to explain. He left and I never heard from him again. I knew what he meant, but one seldom hears it stated quite that openly. The incident involving this young man focuses with unusual clarity the peculiar nature of the social metaphysician's dependence and fear. The dependence is deeper than any practical or tangible consideration. The material forms of parasitism and exploitation that some men practice are merely one of its consequences. The basic dependence is psycho-epistemological, a parasitism of cognition, of judgment, of values, a wish to function within a context established by others, to live by the guidance of rules for which one does not bear ultimate intellectual responsibility. To repeat, a parasitism of consciousness. Since the social metaphysician's pseudo-self-esteem rests on his ability to deal with the world as perceived by others, his fear of disapproval or condemnation is the fear of being pronounced inadequate to reality, unfit for existence, devoid of personal worth, a verdict which he hears whenever he is rejected. The meaning of the boy's statement, "They won't let me live," is they won't keep me alive, they won't take care of me, they'll withdraw their approval. I'll be abandoned in an unknowable reality. The non-venal, non-practical nature of the social metaphysician's dependence is illustrated in the following example. Now, this example was based upon a person who I know myself, but it's a phenomenon which is so common that there are many, many duplicates in small variations of this psychology And I rather suspect that many of you will know from your own experience the kind of type of person I'm talking about. I'm thinking of a social metaphysician who is a multimillionaire and who is obsessively concerned with the issue of what everyone thinks of him, even his office boy. He feels driven to win the office boy's approval or liking. He watches eagerly for any signs of a personal response, and any indication of the boy's indifference or dislike makes him feel depressed or anxious. He finds himself being compulsively charming in order to win the boy's admiration. Now, this man certainly has nothing practical to gain from the boy's favor, neither money, nor advice, nor prestige, nor business advantage. In any practical business sense, the boy is his inferior. Yet the multimillionaire feels that he must win the boy's affection. What significance, then, does the boy have for him? It is not the office boy as an actual person that he seeks to placate or charm, but rather the office boy as a symbol of other people, of any other people, of mankind at large. The implicit thought behind his compulsion is not, this office boy is a potential provider who will take care of me and guide me, but rather, I am acceptable to other people. People who are non-me approve of me. They regard me as a good human being. It is this kind of subservience, this kind of dependence, which is responsible for the profound sense of humiliation which most social metaphysicians endure to a greater or lesser extent. A kind of sense of living under blackmail, of constantly having to placate or appease that nameless others. And here, this sense of humiliation, this fear, this crawling kind of dependence, gives rise to a very significant social phenomenon. It leads to very, very evil consequences socially, to many, but I want to focus on one, and that is that it is this kind of fear which lies at the root of the process by which men can surrender the world to evil. Not a practical fear, that must be emphasized. Not a practical fear, not the response to a tangible threat. Something absolutely non-practical on the deepest level. One of the commonest devices by which the social metaphysician conceals from himself the nature of his own fear and cowardice is to tell himself when he surrenders or capitulates to views or people who he doesn't respect that he's being practical, that he's acting out of practical considerations. I wrote an article dealing with this phenomenon, as I say, some time ago in the newsletter called Social Metaphysical Fear. And to illustrate how this process worked, I gave a few case examples which were based upon individual cases known by me, which are very suggestive because many other closely related types exist, which you will all recognize. I want to quote a bit from myself because these cases are really archetypical. I want you to observe the following in these cases. What these cases illustrate is the manner in which men, prompted by a degrading fear they dare not acknowledge and so cannot overcome, invent non-existent dangers or grossly exaggerate minor ones, betray their own minds, sell out whatever authentic rationality they possess, and contribute to the spread of values inimical to their own, and acquire a vested interest in believing that men are unavoidably evil, that human existence is evil, that the good has no chance on earth. The first case is that of a professor of philosophy who is an atheist. He knows that the arguments for the existence of God are thoroughly indefensible. He regards the notion of a supernatural being as irrational and destructive. He despises mysticism and considers himself an advocate of reason. But he evades the issue of atheism versus theism in his books and lectures, refuses to commit himself on the subject publicly, and every Sunday attends church with his parents and relatives. He does not tell himself that his motive is fear, that he is terrified to stand alone against his family, friends, and colleagues, that violent arguments of any kind make him panicky, and that he desperately wants to feel accepted. No, this is not what he tells himself. Instead, he tells himself that if he were to acknowledge his atheism, his career would be ruined, evading the fact that many professors are known atheists and their careers are unaffected by it. He tells himself that he is reluctant to cause pain to his elderly parents who are devoutly religious and who would be dismayed by his lack of faith, evading the fact that he is not obliged to convert his parents, merely to state his own convictions, and that a man who takes ideas seriously does not sacrifice his own judgments, which he knows to be rational, in order to placate people whose beliefs he knows to be irrational. His rationalizations serve to shield him from a full recognition of his treason. But because it cannot be blanked out entirely, he is condemned to struggle against secret feelings of self-contempt, and he retaliates by cursing the malevolence of the system and of reality, since he cannot have his treason and his self-esteem too. Consider the case of a successful playwright who selects an important theme as the subject of a play, a theme requiring and deserving a serious dramatic presentation, who then realizes that his viewpoint will antagonize a great many people. He decides, therefore, to write the play as a comedy, making good-natured fun of the things he regards as evil, counting on his humor to prevent anyone from taking his view seriously and being offended or antagonized. He does not tell himself that he dreads to be regarded as unfashionable. Instead, he tells himself that serious plays dealing with controversial ideas are non-commercial, and dismisses the many exceptions as freaks requiring no explanation. But he cannot entirely elude the knowledge that he has sold out the motive that prompted his desire to write the play in the first place. So he retaliates against his discomforting sense of moral uncleanliness by cursing the stupidity and the bad taste of the masses. Consider the case of a scientist who despises the obscurantist jargon that is rampant in his profession and the postulates underlying that jargon, who is rationally convinced that the theories of many of his most highly regarded colleagues are wrong. But he twists his brain to adopt that jargon in his own writings, dilutes his criticisms in every possible way, and strives to smuggle his own ideas into the minds of his readers in such a manner that no one will notice the extent of his departure from established belief. He does not tell himself that he is afraid of being ridiculed as an outsider, or that he abjectly hungers for the esteem of men he regards as pretentious and competent. Instead, he tells himself that he is playing it smart, that when he becomes famous, he will be the term setter, and that the practical way to become famous, to become a successful innovator, is to make himself indistinguishable from everyone else. But he cannot entirely drown the knowledge that this was not the view of science with which he started, and that the youth who had been himself would find it strange to be told that devotion to truth is served by catering to falsehood. So he retaliates by cursing the malevolence of a universe in which the concept of a fashionable innovator is a contradiction in terms. Consider finally the all-too-common case of the businessman who recognizes that capitalism is the only rational and just social system. He knows the intelligence, independence, and dedication which industrial production requires. He knows that he earns his profits, he loves his work and is secretly proud of it. But he apologizes for his success publicly, contributes financially to intellectual organizations explicitly devoted to his destruction, accepts the government's expropriation of his wealth and infringement of his rights without moral protest, and begs mankind at large to forgive him for the sin of possessing ability. He does not tell himself that he is afraid to challenge the prevailing value system which damns his way of life as ignoble, selfish, and materialistic, even though that value system has never made sense to him. He does not tell himself that he cannot bear to feel alienated from all those who support that value system. He does not tell himself that the responsibility of passing independent judgments in the realm of morality fills him with dread. Instead, he tells himself that his policy is motivated solely by the desire to protect his business interests, that it is good sense not to antagonize government officials, that it is shrewd public relations to finance intellectuals of the statist persuasion, so that they will see that he is a nice guy, that it is bad business to court unpopularity. His secret fear takes the form of imagining that the masses are unthinking brutes, that they are the ultimate masters of reality, they can kill him and take over his property whenever they wish, so they must be placated, they must be told that he works only to serve them. He must restrain them by assuring them that theirs is the right superseding all other rights. This, he tells himself, is hard-headed realism. But he cannot entirely escape the disquieting awareness somewhere within him that his appeasement is not prompted by the motives he names, that his practicality and cynicism are protective affectations masking something worse. So he retaliates by cursing human irrationality and the malevolence of a world which demands that he be concerned with moral issues one way or the other. Such is the manner in which men deliver the world to evil. In all such cases and countless others, hiding behind the pretense that their fear is of some practical, tangible threat, what is being concealed is the fact that what is really at stake is the issue of standing intellectually alone, of being sovereign in the sphere of value judgments, of pronouncing moral judgments on the fundamental issues of human existence, and of building one's life on those judgments. That is what the social metaphysician is terrified of, and that is the responsibility from which his whole life represents an attempted escape.